feel like there was a possibility of being called up at any point?
That was a possibility, yes. No.
Would you have gone?
Yes, yes.
How big was the threat, do you feel? Or chance of
being? Well, mind you, there were many nurses joining the armed forces because of the Korean War. So, you know, I really didn't think seriously about it one way or the other. As I say, we did go to the States during this period, and we flew with the Americans. We were on exercises, because the injuries coming from Korea were flown from Korea to Tokyo, and from Tokyo to Hawaii, and from Hawaii to an Air Force base in Northern California called Travis. And that's when I said they could admit and discharge 500 patients in a day. And it depended on what condition the serviceman had. If it was a bone condition, he was probably sent to Walter Reed in Washington, which is where they're going now, as injuries from Iraq. They had two criteria. One, where he would get the best care, but if there was an equivalent closer to his home, he'd be flown to a base near his home. If he had burn injuries, he'd be flown to a center in Texas called San Antonio. So we flew with the Americans. We were auxiliary crew for 2 weeks. And then on another occasion, we went to McGuire in New Jersey. We flew from there to Europe and brought patients back who were service personnel in Europe.
What was that experience like?
Well, it was challenging. It was challenging to care for patients. It's a whole new way of caring for patients in confined spaces where they were on litters. There were canvas-like stretchers, and they were on poles. And if you visualize an aircraft, you could have three
stacked on top of each other.
One on top. And I have seen pictures since the war in Iraq has been on of how they're caring for patients. And, you know, it's very sophisticated now. We didn't have all the equipment that they have today. You know, they had we did have respirators. And we did have restraints for patients who had mental illnesses and could endanger themselves or somebody else on the aircraft. From what I have seen on television, you know, they seem to be, you know, carrying out procedures, giving intravenous and blood.
What other challenges did you face with not being able to provide the best care?
They treated them in the hospitals in Europe, military hospitals, and tried to stabilize them so that they could fly, say, for 6 or 8 hours, depending. In those days, you couldn't fly from Europe to the United States without stopping because you didn't have fuel. So they flew from Germany, Rhein-Main in Germany, to the Azores in Portugal, and took the patients off and changed their dressings and gave them you could give them medications on the aircraft, but carry out any procedures that you couldn't do on the plane. And then you brought back onto the plane again and then flown to the United States.
Is there any particular time that you really remember about that experience?
On one occasion I remember quite distinctly, we ran into a hurricane. Late August, I think. And it got very bumpy. And some of the patients were ambulatory patients. They were able to sit in regular seats. And the rest of the patients were down one side of the aircraft. And we had two crews on. We had an American crew and a Canadian crew. We were learning. So we were the second crew. And I can remember the pilot saying, everybody get in their seats. It's going to be rough. And at that point, one of our members was opening a can of soup to give to a patient, and the soup can was down Didn't get the soup. But this went on for, the sky was fiery red for hours. And we were sure we would, you know, in the storm, the plane might have been struck by lightning. Fortunately, it didn't. But it got quite dicey towards the end because we were running very low on fuel. And there were no places to get in because of the storm. We eventually landed in a space in New Jersey, McGuire. But there were the pilot. There were two crews. There was a naval crew and an army, Army Air Force crew, who were taking turns flying the aircraft. The pilot. There were two sets of pilots. One Army Air Force, because in the States, Army Air Force was the same, and naval. And so that was they were called observers. They told the pilot where they were and you know, what the weather conditions were. So there were two sets of everything. And then we had two sets of medical people looking after the patients. So we were, you know, it was a fully booked aircraft. And of course in those days, aircraft still disappear. But a number of aircraft had disappeared during the Korean War, and some were never found, flying from Vancouver up through the Aleutians to Tokyo. That's the shortest route if you're flying across the Pacific. And I can remember saying to the pilot, who was a Southern gentleman, that wasn't an easy do, and he said, it sure wasn't. I was glad to get down. Sure he was.
So you've been in the, from the World War II all through a good chunk of the up until, what time did you discharge? When did you discharge from the town?
The reserve, is it 1960?
1960. Did you notice a big change in women within the military?
You know, there were still rules and regulations, certain things you were not supposed to do.
But what would be integrated into the
military? Well, when you say integrated,
women being allowed to become pilots.
That was in the. I think in the late 60s. As a matter of fact, I think one of the first women who learned to fly and flew service aircraft was a physician. As a matter of fact, she lives in Victoria now, and she'd be a woman probably about 70 now. She was a physician in the Air Force, medical officer, and I think her argument, which was justifiable, if she was treating patients, aircrew, suffering from whatever the condition was that they developed as a result of their flying experience, she should be able to have the opportunity to experience the kinds of things, you know, you can get when the aircraft go up very quickly or go down, you get a blood flow that, if not corrected, they wore something to hear. Keep that from happening, but in a quick dive, it can happen. Anyway, that was her argument, that she needed to experience what they experienced. And I would think it was the late 60s when women started to fly. We're allowed to fly, and of course now they can be in a squadron from Alberta in snowboards. I think recently in fact, there may have been many more, I don't know.
And you were the first registered nurse in the reserve, that's right.
Yeah.
And can you tell me a little bit more about how that came to be?
Well, I guess the reason I knew this was very shortly after I joined the reserve, there was a cocktail party at Sea Island in the officers' mess. And we wore, for dress, we wore a blue two-piece outfit with white collar and cuffs, buttons, Air Force buttons, black shoes and stockings. We wore Oxfords with these uniforms, but you could wear a pump. And I was at this cocktail party, and the Minister of Defense, Brooke Claxton, was at the party, I spoke to him, and he said, "And where are you stationed?" And I said, "Well, I'm really not stationed anywhere. I'm reserved in Vancouver." And he was very surprised to discover that there was a nurse in the reserve. But apparently there was an allocation for such a person, and I guess the commanding officer just decided that they would recruit someone. And there was a chap at Acadia Camp where I was living who was in the reserve, and he told me about the opportunity to join the reserve, and I did. So that's how it happened.
And what were your motivations for joining the reserve?
Well, it was nice to keep up the connection, and it was financially, you know, we didn't make a lot of money. I think we were paid about, well, in the service during the war, as a flying officer, you got $5 a day. But then you got your room and your accommodation. And you could have trips on service aircraft or, you know, other things. But that was the going rate for nurses. When I got out of the service, I did private duty for 3 or 4 months before I went to university. And that was the going rate in 1946, was $5 a month.
Did the military pay for your master's degree too?
No, that
was on your own. And you mentioned you were the head nurse at that time too, is that right? Which is your position at the time?
No, repeat that again.
After you left the service, after the war, and you did your master's, what occupation or what in nursing did you end up with?
Oh, I was the director of the health, public health nursing in Victoria for several years.
How did that experience differ from the military?
Oh, completely different, because we're working in the community.
What did you like better?
I enjoyed the community. There's maybe a sense of freedom that... and chances to make adaptations. The hospitals in those days tended to be pretty rigid and very difficult to get through the various levels to change procedures and to try new things. And that's not this. Now it's much more adaptability than it was then.
As a history buff, do you feel that the documentation of the nurses, the nursing sisters, is representative?
Well, there have been quite a few. There have been quite a few. No, I've got the book here, Nicholson's. And I have done interviews before, you know. I have a friend who started to do histories on nursing sisters from the First and Second World War. And she managed to get those done.
Found that Nicholson's book was pretty consistent with your experiences, or representative of that?
Well, his was a generalization of the history of nursing. You know, the background information of, you know, why the nurses went to the World War, where they were in Europe during the First World War, and there were a lot of fatalities among nursing sisters in the First World War. We only had one in the Second World War, which was, you know, surprising.
Yes.
There were 14 nurses on hospital ships, on a hospital ship off the coast of Ireland, and a German were hit by a submarine.
This is in the Second World
War. First World War. And they got into the lifeboats, the ship was sinking. And we managed to get into the lifeboat, but we didn't have any oars. I think we were 14 or 16. And under international law, it was accepted that the enemy did not strike a hospital ship, and it was, the hospital ship was mine. They don't know whether they got caught in the tide that was created as the ship went under, but they was strongly suspected that they'd been hit again by another torpedo from the submarine. And as a matter of fact, there's been attempts over all these years to get more data on the captain of the submarine, who obviously issued the order to use the torpedo.
When you were flying over seas and what have you, did you ever have that fear of being hit, or was that always a possibility?
Oh, no, that wasn't. No, there was no enemy action in Europe then. No. No. I think the greatest danger was people going by ship to Britain, service personnel, being attacked, and that's why they went in convoy, or merchant marine in the danger area.
Are you glad that you, or would you have liked to experience a more in-depth war? Like, would you have wished that you had the opportunity to go over to?
To go overseas?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Very much so.
Did you try?
No. I don't think there were any nurses who joined who didn't hope or anticipate. But by the law of averages, if you were in the Air Force, the chances were fairly remote.
Thank you. Is there anything else you think would be?
No, I'm the president of the Nursing Sisters Association. Our numbers are dwindling, as you can understand, because of age. But this association was developed after the First World War and carried on, and has carried on. But, as I say, our numbers are dropping because of age. But we meet twice a year. An Armistice Day, and we have a spring luncheon.
I was on the website, and the mission to, I can't remember it word for word, but road supporting the king and making sure that, do you know what I'm talking about?
Don't say that again.
Yeah,
it was just the same as any group of people who've gone through the same experiences, and alumni of any kind. Mm-hmm. You share the same background of experiences, and you just maintain that by socializing. And it's the same. Nurses graduating from, you probably don't, it doesn't exist now because it's an entirely different educational approach, but the old hospital schools of nursing, and they're none in existence now, but probably the last one closed about 25 years ago. But every, you say, 5 years after graduation, 10 years, 25, 50, my school and class had a gathering 2 years ago on our 60th.
What are your duties as the president?
Oh, really, very minimal. Just organizing and making sure the lists are kept up to date, and I was just talking to a friend of mine yesterday who was a nursing sister, and we were trying to arrange to take, we have, you know, many, well, I'd say many, there are several nursing sisters in Broadmead, the DPA facility, that we would take some plants to those that are patients there, and to other nursing sisters who are in facilities in the city, in retirement facilities, or what's the other, there's a new term now, assisted living.
So the camaraderie that you were talking about before is still very
Yeah,
much.
It's greatly diminished, you know, because, you know, people have memory loss and physical limitations. And but I met Jean in France. She was working there as a civilian when I went over in 56.
What was that experience like?
Well, that was challenging because we...
You were on the NATO base as well then?
No.
Yeah.
We looked after families. She had a lot of obstetrics. And a fair amount of pediatrics. As well as sick parades for the service personnel. And, you know, the required hospitalization. I guess it was about a 40-bed hospital.
And sick parades, just to clarify... What?
Oh, you've got, it's just like going to an outpatient's department. You get your name and your complaint, and you sit and wait to see a physician or a nurse, depending on what your problem is.
Did they ever have health checks for all the soldiers, or was it just if you had a particular health issue?
Well, we had immunization parades. Everybody had to be immunized for smallpox, tetanus, and then when polio vaccine came in, everybody had to have polio immunization. And if somebody was posted to a remote area, they would have to have the medication that was prescribed. For instance, if you were going to someplace in South America, service personnel, they would have to have a yellow fever. Any areas that had specific one, malaria.
How would your experience at the NATO base in France have differed from Jean's and the fact that she was a civilian and you were military person?
Well, we were not really. There wasn't too much difference.
She said that she had a fair amount of time off to travel. Would that be consistent?
Oh, we all worked the same schedule. We worked generally 7 days. On night duty, 4 to 12 or 12 to 8, without any time off. And then when we came off, you got 2 days and a half of the week you were on, and then 2.5 days for the following week. So you could put those days together and sometimes be off for 6 or 7 days.
Did you travel a lot over there?
Everybody bought cars. If you were service personnel and you're out of the country for more than 6 months, you didn't have to pay any tax on cars. So that made it quite a reasonable purchase. And most of us brought our cars back because for $100 came back by ship, you could pay to have the car shipped back. So all you had to pay was $100.
How long were you?
Just under 2 years.
Were you in the same barracks living as Jean was with the Ruby women, men in terms of the floors? Is that consistent for you still?
I don't remember. In Armenia and our brothers. We had the nurses' quarters.
Okay.
And airmen's quarters. And officers' quarters. Now, whether people got in and out, that's a different matter. But, I mean, basically. And we also had teachers who taught that each base had a school.
Was it at the NATO bases in a lot of different countries, or was it?
There were some. Even France, of course, and they might be there for training purposes. And there were four bases in France. Four NATO bases, Canadian NATO bases. Two in France and two in Germany.
Which one in France were you
at? Marville. And then there was another one not too far, well, maybe 80 or 90 miles away at Gourtonquin. And then there were two. And we'd sometimes take patients. The largest military hospital was at the base in Germany. So you might fly them or take them by ambulance to that hospital if the treatment was something that was not available. And it was pretty limited treatment other than this one hospital. And then if it was required further investigation, that we'd take them to an American hospital in Landstuhl, which is the hospital that I'm talking about now where the Americans all go from Iraq.
How did that experience in France differ from the Prairies?
Well, we took care of families, you see. In service hospitals across Canada, you only looked after service personnel during the war. Then after the war, most of the majority of Air Force and Army stations closed, but there were some. And then the government agreed to provide care to the families of service personnel who were stationed at various places. So that the services expanded to include families in Canada and also in Europe.
Jean was talking about how they used to have the competitions between the countries, the flight competitions. Do you remember that? The Canadians usually came in first.
What kind of competition are you talking
about? I'm not sure about the details, but it was about something about flying to a certain point and coming back.
Well, you know, they went to certain places in Europe for certain types of experiences. They went to Italy and they went to North Africa. But I wasn't aware of any.
I think it was a training competition, usually between the countries in the conflict.
What happened? I wasn't
aware. She was just saying that sometimes there would be accidents involved.
Oh, yeah, I see what you mean. There'd be exercises, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, there could be, you know, there are consequences if, you know, because these were fighter squadrons, mm-hmm. single pilot. And, of course, there could be accidents in transport. There was a very nasty accident, and Jean was there before I arrived. I don't know how many people were killed. Because, you know, the aircraft would come to various bases and pick up personnel and fly them to London or to a base in England or they were transported by air. If they were going to, this would be probably officers of a higher rank who were going to NATO meetings and things. You know, there were aircraft coming and going all the time. One of the largest, biggest problems we had were car accidents. The first week I was there, I think there were four fatalities. It was a bad combination. The young airman, not used to drinking wine in the local cafes, driving an American car on a French road, I produced four fatalities. Because in France, many of the roads are lined by trees, and they're a very dangerous component of mitigates against safe driving.
What was your position at the NATO base?
Well, I was just a regular, you know, a nursing sister, relieving. I was still reserve, but I was now there were certain. I say privileges that we probably had You see, the nurses would be, the civilian nurses would be paid a regular salary, but they wouldn't have some of the perks that we had because we were part of the military.
What kind of perks did you
have? Well, we probably got extra. So we get clothing allowance. What else did we get? I don't know whether our holiday time varied or not. I'm not sure. But we were entitled to a month's holiday a year. And it would depend, I guess, on the civilian nurses, how long they were there. I would presume they probably got the same holiday entitlements. But you see, there weren't a lot. There were only, I would say, 4 out of 25 at Marville were civilians. The rest were service personnel.
What was the interaction between the nurses and the officers and their families there? Was it merely professional, or did you
know? Well, you know, you would get to know the gatherings. You'd meet the wives of the officers, and you know, you'd be invited sometimes to their homes for, say, Christmas or a special occasion.